and welcome to the Vicar's Watch Dibley,
the podcast where real priests talk about pop culture and what we've learned about faith life in the church. We've watched Dibley, now we're watching everything else. I'm Kate.
I'm Ross.
And I'm Ruthie. Today we're going to talk about the last two episodes of Rev. Finally, we're talking about Rev, which I know some of you have been waiting for.
Holy happy hello to you all.
Hello.
Hello.
We're in our vicarages, you're listening in, and we're ready and raring to talk about Rev. But first, Ross, I think you have a little notice for us today.
I do. First of all, I just want to say I'm sorry if my recording sounds a bit strange, because I am in the middle of moving house, and they've taken a lot of my stuff already, so my house is feeling very echoey. And I'm out of the cupboard, which is usually my little recording booth. So I'm out of the closet and into the light. Here I am. But yeah, no, absolute chaos for me at the moment. We're recording in the middle of Lent. I'm just in the chaos of trying to work out where my furniture is going.
This episode that we're recording now is going to come out just before Holy Week. So we decided it was a perfect time to finally watch Rev and talk about Rev. So, Ross, tell us about Rev.
Okay. So, Rev is a sitcom that came out between 2010 and 2014. And it's kind of almost, in many ways, an opposite to The Vicar of Dibley. The Vicar of Dibley is a lovely rural community, whilst Rev is a chaotic, dysfunctional, inner-city London parish. That makes Dibley sound like it's functional, and actually, it isn't.
I should
make that clear. it follows the story of the Reverend Adam Smallbone. He's moved from a idyllic rural Suffolk parish to be in inner-city London, to St. Saviour's in the Marshes. It kind of follows his journey as he engages with what is kind of a really brutal ministry. I'm just going to throw back to you right now, because it is so very different from The Vicar of Dibley. How much of it have you two watched? Because I'm going to confess, I started watching it. I don't think I've actually seen season two. And then I've seen the end of it. I've seen the Alpha and the Omega, but not the rest of the Greek alphabet.
Yeah, I've seen bits of it. I've watched the odd episode. It's very difficult to watch.
I believe I've seen it all now. So, like Fleabag, that got to an episode that I watched and went, no, can't watch anymore. It's too painful, which was the episode 4 of season 3, which is where, massive spoiler alert for all of this, the vicar, Rev, Adam Smallbone, kisses the head teacher of the Church of England school and is racked with guilt about it. And then there's an artist who makes a statue it's of the artist kissing his wife, but Rev sees it, Adam sees it, and thinks it's of him and Ellie, who is the head teacher, and so pushes it over and smashes it. And I got to that point and just went, I can't deal with the emotional turmoil of all of this. But I have now watched all of it, and I am once again glad that I have watched all of it. But it's been a long time since I've watched it before.
Rev has a whole cast of eccentric characters, just like the Vicar of Dibley.
Absolutely.
And actually, I think we see much more of a cross-section of the Church of England than the bubble of Dibley gives us. So we have Adam, who is played by Tom Hollander.
Mr. Collins.
Mr. Collins, yeah.
We could talk about him again, couldn't we, Kate?
We should try to get an interview of him about the different vicars he's played.
Amazing.
Yes.
His wife is called Alex, played by Olivia Colman. And as a Vicar's wife, she has her own career. She is a solicitor.
She doesn't like being the Vicar's wife either, does she? And she makes it very clear that she's not on board with all of this. Which is, I think, worth pointing out that not every Vicar's spouse signed up for this originally and has often kind of, you know, if they've got ordained later on in life, didn't expect to marry a vicar, and here they are. So, yeah. Carry on, sorry.
No, go ahead. We've got, within his team at the church, we've got Nigel, who is the lay reader. You want to explain what a lay reader is, please, Kate?
Yes, so a lay reader is someone who has been trained and authorised by the Church of England to take services and to preach. You may find them taking funerals and various other services, but they are not priests. So lay means not ordained. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
So they can't do Holy Communion or...
Yeah, they can't do Holy Communion or anything sacramental, but they are incredibly important for the church and really valuable. If you have a lay reader in your parishes, it is a blessing.
Yes.
And sometimes Nigel is a blessing to Adam, but sometimes he is not, and we'll get into that a little bit later on. But in the sitcom, Nigel is fastidious about church law and the rules, and can sometimes undermine Adam and his leadership as vicar. But we'll come on to more of that later on. I mentioned a couple of the parishioners. We've got Colin, who is a bit of sort of a... Well, Wikipedia says he's a heavy-drinking, unemployable, lost soul.
Yeah.
And Adam's most devoted parishioner. And he's often turning up with his dog. He and Adam are often sort of sharing a cigarette somewhere.
Yeah, smoking on the bench outside the church.
There is Adoa, who is... she is best known, really, for her sort of very romantic intentions towards towards Adam or the clergy.
I'd forgotten about that, yeah.
Again, according to Wikipedia. Something which... sometimes called in the church a cassock chaser.
Yeah, she is at the beginning. I'd forgotten that.
But she's someone who's very faithful to the church and to church teaching, but that can sometimes make her a little bit blind to what people actually need, perhaps.
Yeah.
There is then, we've mentioned Ellie. She is the head teacher of the local parish primary school. Professional. And very committed to her career. And she's very beautiful.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that is sort of sold to us, I think, as within the world of the sitcom. And we're going to get more into that as we hit the episodes. Finally, there is the Archdeacon Robert. Now, we may recognise Archdeacon Robert from The Vicar of Dibley. Go on, Kate.
Oh, yes.
He is our lovely choir conductor from Dibley Church.
Cecil.
What's his name
again? Darling Cecil.
Cecil!
Who... clearly has had a name change and a promotion.
A new calling.
In my head canon, it is the same character.
Is it twin brothers?
Or they're
twin brothers, maybe. Or cousins, perhaps. He gets around, he travels around a lot in a taxi cab, doesn't he, around London?
Yeah.
And this is one of the things which, when Rev was first released, there was lots of chatter about people who knew the people who each of these characters were based on. And one of those was that there was an archdeacon who travelled around London in black cabs.
To my
knowledge. The youth worker who I was working with at the time knew an archdeacon who fit this description.
It's a fascinating sitcom to watch if you are embedded in the Church of England in the same way that we are, and especially if you know London clergy, I think, because these are really strong archetypes, and actually we can probably say, oh, we know exactly who that is. we all know someone a bit like that.
Okay. It's a funny thing about archdeacons, isn't it? I've met some prickly ones before, and then I've met some absolutely fantastic ones before. So he's definitely on the prickly end, isn't he? Of just having conversations with people in cabs and then chucking them out. So
yeah, if you don't know what an archdeacon is, it's sort of like middle management in the church. Would you say?
Yeah, I think that works.
If the bishops are the managers, then the archdeacons are sort of the middle managers.
Often look after the sort of the more legal side of churches, but also have oversight of the pastoral needs and cares of clergy and their churches as well.
I've got a cracking archdeacon.
Yeah, that depends on the size of the diocese as well. So a really big diocese, like one of the London dioceses, will have actually quite powerful archdeacons. They'll have quite significant roles. So in this episode, we do also have the bishop, who you will recognise as Ralph Fiennes from various different media.
We had him last time we recorded, didn't we? He was the pharaoh.
Yes, so on the episode which was released in our podcast episode, which was released before this, he played the Pharaoh. You'll also know him from various other TV shows and films.
A big actor in the cast for like the finale episodes of this sitcom.
He plays Jesus in The Miracle Maker as well, so there's quite few ones there's a bit of a faith aspect to his role. So
we'll have to get him on the podcast too.
He also plays Voldemort, so
you know.
Unfortunately, as I was watching this, I was just hearing in my head that the boy who lived. Come to die, like just that interview where he and Adam were having the interview together. Very interesting flashbacks there. Anyway, I think one of the we've mentioned how these characters are based on, some of them are based on real archetypes and encounters people have had with real clergy, and also real parishioners. And I think maybe one of the reasons I find it harder to watch Rev is because it's real in a much more gritty way than The Vicar of Dibley is. I would say we recognise the characters in The Vicar of Dibley, but it's a lot more uplifting, and even though it can be dire, it doesn't feel grim. Whereas the Rev, the Rev characters and situations feel a little bit more grim and just too real. And bog you down a little bit if you're actually going through similar situations.
Yeah, there's an episode where they have, I'm pretty sure it's Miles Jupp. Oh, not Miles Jupp, Hugh Bonneville, who plays a character that's doing a church growth thing. And I work for something called Leading Your Church into Growth. And that felt like a stab in the heart of, oh no, all my cliches that I do, this is me standing up. And so watching that was a bit like, oh. But, you know, actually, it's one of the things we need to look at ourselves and laugh at ourselves and go, you know, we recognise when we've got it wrong. And there's the other classic one with the kind of evangelical free church comes in and, you know, does rapping smoothie for bar. Jesus and smoothie bar and all this kind of stuff, where you look at that and go, oh, I recognise so much of that.
Yeah. It's really good that everyone is fair game, though.
Yes.
Like, you've got the slightly hapless middle-of-the-road vicar in Adam Smallbone. You've got the slightly more charismatic big shot vicars as played by Hugh Bonneville. You've got the evangelicals and the sort of slightly intimidating sort of high church archdeacons, if you like. Everyone is fair game. And I think that's a kind thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually it does make those moments of hope and resurrection so much brighter in contrast to how dire everything else can feel, and particularly the episodes we've watched, which we'll get onto in a moment, Adam really hits incredible lows, yeah. But that just makes the encounters with God and the glimmers of hope all the more powerful. Whereas I think in Vicar of Dibley, we have Geraldine, she has her lows and she has her dark nights of the soul, yeah. But everything's tied up at the end of the episode, and the expression of her dark night of the soul is a little bit more comedic in terms of, oh, she's eaten a whole freezer of ice cream.
Yeah.
Or she's eaten a massive number of curly whirlies. Or whatever it is. Whereas actually with Adam, we see, we really do see the darkness as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a really interesting moment in these closing episodes about, we've seen these kind of caricature characters for 3 seasons, I think it is, over 4 years. And but we get an insight into personal prayers,
yeah.
In these Easter episodes, where we hear a little bit about actually what is their relationship with God like.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, I thought it might be nice just to touch on that here.
Yeah.
Actually, what do you think about those prayers and what is revealed to us about these characters through their prayers?
It was one of the things I really loved when I first started watching it, was hearing this inner monologue of Adam praying at different times and praying like I do. Mm. And just kind of, it's not sat down formal and going through morning prayer or whatever it might be, but actually just going, you know, God, I'm having a bit of a rubbish day today and I could just do with your help. But I saw a dog today that was pretty nice. And, you know, it's like, it's these kind of weird mundane prayers where you're just having a chat and asking questions. And I love that that is part of it. And that's a very constant for Adam throughout the whole of the kind of series. But I loved that in the final episode, you hear that from other characters more. And yeah, I think it's a really clever storytelling device.
Yeah, and gave us an insight, Ross, as you said, into what each of the other characters was thinking. And I think there's almost a softening of Nigel's character in that we discover really the struggles, what he's wrestling with, which is what has led him to be so critical of Adam.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you sort of see, I mean, I love Adam's wife. Sorry, I don't know Alex. Her name.
Ellie. Oh, sorry. Oh,
Ellie's Alex. Her teacher.
I love Alex's prayer where she's just saying, you know, it's on me to help Adam now, which is just, it's lovely. And seeing her, her faith as well. Yeah, it's just really nice. And also seeing the Archdeacon, who's been this very pompous character, and seeing what he thinks of himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah.
And Colin, actually, how, despite that he really has turned on Adam in these two episodes, actually seeing, hearing his affection for Adam in those private thoughts.
Yeah. It's a really, really good thing.
Mm. Yeah, so Rev is in many ways a bit more realer than Vicar of Dibley. We see in its location, it's less idealised, and it also draws on the fact that the parish is more than just the church and the vicarage and the village hall. It's also the local shop, the local pub, the local park, the church school, all of which actually are really important in the parish, because the Church of England is about parish ministry rather than just about church. It's so it's really interesting.
Some of the best ministry I do is in the pub here. Like, the conversations I have with people are absolutely brilliant. And it's more than just the church building. There's people I bump into at regular places and go, oh, hello again, how are you doing? And it's more than the building.
Yeah, it's in the schools.
Yeah.
Lots of my ministry happens in the schools. And it's when you're walking the dog and the people you meet when you're walking the dog, or when you're going into the local shop, and through relationships with the local shop, they also own a pub, so we're able to do events in the pub. And it kind of all links together, and that's really nice. Yeah, so I think Rev's really good at representing that.
It's really interesting how they draw out actual issues that a lot of clergy face. I remember in season one, there's the episode where suddenly a whole load of families with kids start coming to the church. And it's because they want to get their kids into the good church school. And Adam has a really difficult time, ethically and morally, trying to work out what he should do. Should he sign this form from these parents who've turned up for the last 2 weeks trying to get their kids into the nice school or not? On one hand, he could get his church to grow massively. But on the other hand, he and his congregation are being somewhat used for their kids, their education or whatever. It's really interesting because there are a lot of clergy who have to work out those dynamics. What should the policy be in terms of church membership and access to this, the local parish school?
What does church membership look like? So even for things like baptisms and weddings, families need to have a qualifying connection to the church. And I think perhaps it's a bit more relevant in rural ministry where you've got lots of pretty little churches. And so you've got to say, well, what is a qualifying connection? If we're reading it to the letter, then we need to have seen someone regularly over 6 months at church services. But is that a connection? Or, you know, and it's really interesting how you interpret the church law, but also in relation to what is actual relationship. And we don't want, it's really interesting. It's a really interesting aspect of parish ministry.
We've also had episodes looking at safeguarding. What happens when someone who's got a criminal record joins the church congregation and brings certain skills with them. There's an episode about gay marriage and what Adam's wants to do with his, you know, and how his conscience leads him forward. At the time when the church, well, certainly between 2010 and 2014, the Church of England didn't really know what it's doing. I don't know how much further we are now, and I've been sitting on General Synod the last 2 years. So it's really a really great sitcom for exploring a lot of really contemporary issues that the church is working itself through.
So if you want to know what it's really like in church ministry and parish ministry, watch Rev. But maybe don't try to marathon it, because it might...
No.
Yeah.
It's not a binge.
Watch it interspersed with Vicar of Dibley. Those little injections of levity.
God, that's going to be the weirdest binge ever, isn't it?
Weirdest binge. Yeah. It would be a really interesting one to do. We're going to create a watching plan. Anyway, we've specifically chosen Rev because this episode is coming out at Holy Week. And so let's talk about what episodes have we watched.
We have watched season 3, episodes 5 and 6. These are the last two episodes of Rev. It's sort of set in the run-up to Easter. It is sort of set during Lent. Earlier in the series, Adam and Ellie, the head teacher of the school, shared a kiss. In episode 4, he and his wife Alex talk about it, and that's all resolved between them. But in episode 5, we see the news spreading as a complaint is made against Adam, and he is suspended from active ministry. The news spreads around the parish, an investigation is held, run by the archdeacon. We see Adam meeting with the bishop. In episode 6, we see how things are resolved from that, and how Adam and Alex begin to look forward as to what might come next. It's safe to say that Adam has a real wrestling over his vocation, whether he's called to be a priest or not. He does start looking for other jobs outside of the church. And we'll come to the resurrection, maybe some of the endings towards the end. But I thought one thing that might be fun to do might be actually, because it is grounded in Holy Week, and it's such a, they're such clever episodes in the way that they bring in all of these allusions to the events of Holy Week that Jesus and the disciples lived through.
Yeah.
So I thought it might be fun to go through day by day.
But first, let's just clarify what Holy Week is. Just not making the assumption that people know. So Holy Week is the most sacred week in the Christian calendar. It is the week leading up to Easter. It begins with Palm Sunday, goes through Holy Monday and Tuesday. Then we have Spy Wednesday, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and then Easter Day. And it is marked by lots of really interesting and slightly weird traditions, as in the church we relive those final days of Jesus' life and the things that he did with his disciples. It's very much a reenactment, not just performance, but very much something which I think, at least for me, happens emotionally as well. It's a time of great highs and great lows of a triumphal entry with Palm Sunday. This year, my group, we're doing a procession of the palms from one of the village halls to the churches, and I think we might actually have a donkey this year, I've been
How
told.
How exciting.
Oh my goodness, I know. And then the next thing we're doing is we're going to be having a supper on Monday, Thursday. We're going to have some hours at the cross on Good Friday, and then a service of Tese prayer for a final hour at the cross. And then on Easter morning, we're having a dawn service at 6 a.m. at my smallest church, which is in a farmyard. And then we've got a couple of other Easter morning communions as well. I'm really looking forward to it. I love Holy Week. And the week before, I'm actually doing a special Explore Holy Week day with the church school, where each of the classes is going to spend the first morning in workshops creating a station for Holy Week. Exploring a section of the story and creating something for others to experience. And the second half of the day, they'll be travelling around each other's classrooms to journey through Holy Week. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I'm going to be arriving in my new context at Thorpe Cathedral very soon and straight into an already planned out Holy Week. So I'm kind of excited just to kind of live through Holy Week at the cathedral. And to some extent, to not have to think about it too much this year. Ruthie, what are your Holy Week plans? Have you got things sorted? That's okay. You don't need to know yet. There's still time.
You'll discover.
It's a bit complicated here because one of my churches, just before Palm Sunday, is doing a silent movie thing where we play, we move all the pews from church, we have tables out, we're doing it over two nights because it's so popular now, it has been just on one night, and this amazing organist comes as we show these silent movies and does the score, improvises the score for it. It's amazing, it's really, really cool.
That sounds really cool.
So the church up here is kind of a blank canvas in some ways of how it's going to look. Also on Palm Sunday, there is a fell race that happens here. And being the vicar, I get to bless all the runners before they disappear off. So it's like, there's lots of things going on here. And then also up here at Heptonstall, on Good Friday, they do Paceg, which isn't what you think it is. So some people know of Paceg, where they roll eggs down the hill. As far as I know, they do plays here and people slowly drink more and more and more. So it's slightly bonkers what's going on. And then I've got down the hill at my other church, there's the church school and all that they've got going on. So it's kind of, I'm trying to work out what happens kind of socially and culturally around here, but also what happens church-wise. So, and what has happened and what hasn't happened. So I'm trying to do a bit of all things. And one of the things I'm doing is a shared meal on Monday, Thursday with all the churches coming together because there will be tables and chairs out at one of them. already so that we can spend that time together eating, going through Holy Communion and, yeah, reenacting it as we do it. So who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's worth knowing that every church really does have different traditions and every community has different ways of doing things. You know, growing up, our churches always had a walk of witness on Good Friday. None of my churches around here are interested in doing a
walk of
witness.
They used to do a walk of witness, and I heavily dissuaded them from doing one because I don't like walks of witnesses. I'm yet to see it done well because I always think, everyone else is gearing up for Easter and they're like, yay, bunnies and chocolate. And then all the Christians walk through with a cross looking miserable on Good Friday. And it's like, oh, yes, I'd love to be involved in the church. Look at all those miserable Christians. So if you know any ways that it can be good, let me know.
So, hi, listeners. A walk of witness is when...
Oh, yeah.
often churches will have a procession, often through town or through the high street. Somebody is carrying often a very large cross, and the idea is that we are walking with Jesus at the time when he was walking, carrying the cross to Golgotha, that is the place of the skull where Jesus was crucified. And often it's an ecumenical event where lots of different churches in a town will come together and make the thing happen. I remember just before lockdown, and actually lockdown meant it didn't happen, but we were looking in my curacy town of Whitney to kind of reinvigorate the churches together and to try and bring new life. And I ended up being the vice chair of Churches Together. And I said, I will do the Walk of Witness. Give it to me. I'll make it good. because often it becomes this really... tricky thing, and you get church politics and some, and like, you know, some people come like, a woman can't carry the cross or whatever. And I was like, there's a really good way of doing this. So I was planning a whole thing where we're going to start at one church and have the trial, and then all the readings were just going to be straight from scripture, and then we're going to walk to another church and you could join us there if you wanted, where we'd hear the trial and it would be all the clergy of the town being the priest and then, you know, accusing Jesus. And then we go to another church for the trial or something, and then we would walk into town for the crucifixion. And I was trying to build it into this much more missional, exciting event, and then COVID hit. So it's like, yeah, no, never mind. That's not happening.
Firstly, you just described three trials, which is very exciting and probably actually, in fact, is biblical. I've been inspired because, firstly, growing up in our market town, it was an ecumenical thing. It was churches together. We went around the different churches. There was something happening in each church and we finished on a hill. And we were singing songs of praise as we went around. So it wasn't necessarily a gloomy sadness. There was actually a sense of celebration as well, which is weird for Good Friday. But one of the things I'd love to do, so in one of my parishes there's a Catholic abbey, Belmont Abbey, and you can walk from Clihonga Church to Belmont Abbey across the fields, and I thought that might be a really interesting one to do. I need to get in touch with the Catholics and see if we could do something there next Good Friday.
So is the Walk of Witness always on Good Friday? Because in this episode of Rev, it's Palm Sunday that we see them kind of doing a Walk of Witness. It's when Adam and Alex are sat in a cafe because he's been suspended, and they see Adoa walking with some other churches carrying palm crosses, and Adam looks a bit sad that he's not involved in something like that.
So I think what we have happening in these episodes of Rev is that what they bear witness to is the Palm Sunday procession. But what our plan is, listeners, is we're going to go day by day of Holy Week, but this might mean that we're jumping a little bit about in Adam's life and experience in these episodes. Because actually they've put in a lot of effort into the themes of Holy Week, and they kind of follow they don't follow Adam's Holy Week. They follow Adam's life, I think, yeah. really. So it's not an immediate. You can't.
It's not a direct mapping.
No.
That's the phrase. I had mapping in my head. I was like, that's the word.
It's not a direct mapping of, you know, of continuity. No. It's all chopped up. So let's start with Palm Sunday then. And there is a procession of the palms, or possibly a walk of witness, or possibly a Stations of the Cross procession.
Well, we know it's a Sunday because Adam and Alex are saying this is their first Sunday together. Mm. And they've just gone to a cafe to have breakfast together with their baby daughter. And they happen to see over the road a church doing its palm procession through the local area. And they notice Adoa, who was a parishioner of Adam's. And she's part of this hymn-singing, palm-waving procession. Yeah. And they both read into it signs. You know, maybe it's a sign.
Yeah. And it's an interesting distance because on Palm Sunday and the procession of the palms, as we call it, we celebrate the triumphal entry of Jesus entering Jerusalem. Yeah. And for Adam to be outside of this demonstrates his separation and how he's not in that moment of triumph emotionally.
It's really sad. But so there's
a certain dislocation. And Palm Sunday is one of the highs of Holy Week. So I know that as a priest, I'd be really sad if I couldn't be part of Palm Sunday.
One thing that's quite interesting, actually, is about Palm Sunday is that after the procession on that Sunday service, you would usually have the liturgy of the Passion, where the whole story of Holy Week is then told. And part of me thinks that's because a lot of people may not be able to go to services during the week. Maybe they're at work, maybe they're away or at school or whatever. But if you jump straight from Sunday to Sunday, you would go from the triumphal entry, isn't everything amazing on Palm Sunday, to, oh wow, isn't everything amazing still on true. Easter Day, without missing all of the death and darkness and sorrow of the rest of the week.
Yes.
So with that, let's move into Spy Wednesday.
Can I say, I only discovered about Spy Wednesday about 2 years ago or something like that. I had never heard of Spy Wednesday. And then my partner Nat told me about it, at which point I burst out laughing and was saying, this is so silly. Why on earth do we have Spy Wednesday? And so I decided to dress up as a spy that entire day. And so wore the big coat with a collar pumped up and a fake moustache and a hat. And was wandering round with a newspaper, spying on Nat, going, nothing to see here, because I'd never heard of it, and it seems very silly.
I didn't hear about it until I was an adult either, and when I've done assemblies about Holy Week, and I've had props for each of the days, I've had like a robber's mask, and enjoyed putting that on a kid for Spy Wednesday.
Well, you'd have for 30 pieces of silver, because Spy Wednesday is the day when Judas is convinced to betray Jesus. And so he has his secret meeting with the religious leaders to plan what's going to happen.
And he becomes a spy.
And I think when we're thinking about what's going on in Rev, prior to the episode, there is, if you like, the betrayal with a kiss, as Adam and Ellie, the head teacher, share a kiss. And that's what causes the trial and the investigation. But I think there's more to it than that as well.
Yeah.
One of the great conflicts is the relationship between Nigel and Adam, because it's Nigel who writes a letter and sends it to the bishop and the archdeacon, telling them that this happens between Adam and Ellie.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's really interesting seeing their relationship sort of break apart during that time.
Yeah, there's very much a betrayal there, and you see that Adam feels betrayed, while at the same time Nigel is trying to still act like it's business as usual. Yeah. Which maybe is a bit like Judas greeting Jesus with a kiss, in that Nigel's saying, you know, we're not allowed to talk about the complaint, so let's just talk about services.
Yeah. Pastoral visiting.
Pastoral visiting. And he's expecting things to just carry on as normal. Whereas for Adam, this is actually a huge betrayal for Nigel, because Nigel has kick-started a clergy discipline measure investigation, which is actually very, very serious.
But in defence of Nigel, actually, in some ways, he was right to bring up what happened. Like, Adam is not in a good place. Yeah. The thing that happened with Ellie should not have happened. And you can see, like, there's been so much pressure building up on him because he's basically got the threat of closure over him. Like, the church's finances aren't in a great place and they're threatening to close the building. And so there's all this coming up and Adam does something really stupid and acknowledges that. But it's not a... They don't have a good relationship, do they, Nigel and Adam? No. And so there isn't the chance to say, look, I saw what happened with Ellie. I think you need to talk about it. There isn't a good relationship with the Archdeacon that Adam would feel able to go, look, I've really messed up with this. I need help. Nor is there with the bishop. There doesn't seem anyone that he could talk to. And so Nigel is right in bringing it up because he needs to deal with this, Adam. But the way he does it feels sneaky.
Yeah, and also I think maybe it exposes, in the process of the investigation and the different interviews, exposed as actually how incredibly fractured the relationship between Nigel and Adam is before this. So things like the little asides that Adam had made about Ellie, which Nigel hadn't felt able to challenge at the time, and the fact that he didn't feel able to challenge Adam directly about the kiss, but felt that he had to go directly to the Archdeacon and the bishop. And also, Adam clearly doesn't understand what's happening in Nigel's life. We discover in his prayer, in the final episode, we discover that he is struggling with his sexuality. And there's a lot of pent-up self-hatred there, which is being projected outwards, and we discover through his prayer, which, you know, Adam, there clearly isn't that strong enough pastoral relationship between Adam and Nigel.
No, either. Adam does know what's going on. He knows the gay, doesn't he? As in, Nigel hasn't specifically told him, but there's the bit where he's sofa surfing in the episode 4, which you guys wouldn't have seen, but he stays on Nigel's couch, which is also his bed, and like Nigel's put like a picture of his fake girlfriend up and left a pair of pants in the fold out bed, being like, oh, she's done it again, and all this kind of stuff. And it's like Adam knows exactly what's going on, but they haven't got that relationship that can go, look, do you want to talk about this and all of this? I can't remember if Nigel knows anything about the gay wedding. Can't remember that episode and how he reacts to that, but
and anyway, Adam has perceived Nigel's actions as a massive betrayal, and I think that's why we're mapping it to Spy Wednesday. So then we move on to Maundy Thursday, which is traditionally where we remember the Last Supper that Jesus has with the disciples. We remember the prayers in the Garden of Gethsemane, and it's a time where we have the last communion until Easter, and we also would then strip the church, taking out all the ornaments and decorations from the church, so that it's a somber attitude for Good Friday and Holy Saturday. So what's happening in Rev that we thought matched that?
In terms of the Last Supper, we don't seem to have an out-and-out sort of Last Supper moment, but there are times where food comes up. And I was thinking, I think it's a meeting with the bishop or the archdeacon, correct me, I think it's the bishop, where he pulls like a baby rusk out of his pocket.
Chocolate,
in the chocolate, and he's always offering tea or coffee, and the bit with the archdeacon said, "Your coffee's always disgusting," or whatever. And the bishop has a whole selection of teas to be chosen from. So there's something interesting about his hospitality, but the way that the bishop breaks the chocolate is reminiscent of the, to me, of the way that priests snap the Eucharistic wafer.
That's good.
Yeah, we also have the emptying of a church.
Quite literally.
Church is being measured up to be sold, and then they quite literally empty it of everything and then lock it up.
It's really sad.
And actually also on Maundy Thursday we have the arrest and trial of Jesus, which happens overnight.
Let's just sit with the stripping of the church for a moment. Mm-hmm. Because that's a really important part of the Maundy Thursday service, where especially in very high churches, the whole sanctuary area of the church up around the altar is stripped. All the statues are covered up, and altar linen and candlesticks are carried out, all the church furniture, and it's really dramatic and really powerful piece of liturgy within the life of the church. And in the Rev, we see the church being emptied because it is now no longer fit for worship. It is going to be sold off for millions of pounds,
see statues, bubble wrapped, and taken out, and all the pews removed, and everything like that. But the font remains, which is important for later on.
And the church is surrounded by metal and fences, and you know, it is closed off. The church is shut. And indeed, one of the ideas after that service is that you leave the church in silence. Some churches may have their Garden of Gethsemane, Garden of Repose within the church. Some will go elsewhere. But the idea is you leave the church in silence, and you do not return until the day of triumph.
Maybe. Unless you're then redecorating the church.
Unless you're going in to redecorate the church, or you keep the 3 hours on Good Friday.
Sneaking in. Quick, get the flowers in.
It's a really powerful moment. I mean, realistically, it takes a lot longer for a church to actually be closed.
The
Church of England. It's not a snap of fingers and the church cake is closed and can be sold off. It would take a lot more time. But
another thing that happens on this Maundy Thursday then is the trial and the investigation into Adam's conduct with Ellie and whether he has been inappropriate. So there's the meeting with the bishop where we see the archdeacon put in his place, which is quite satisfying to see when the archdeacon's told to go off and make the cups of tea and all this stuff. And the bishop is talking about the complaint of the letter, and he starts off really well, I think, when he says about the response was maybe written in the heat of the moment and all of this. But then it's clear that Adam is being, in quotation marks, put on trial, that he has to, the situation has to be investigated to check what has happened, who's involved, you know, how big a boo-boo was it, and what are the steps forward as part of this. And so we see the archdeacon going round and interviewing all the different parties, so interviewing Adam and interviewing Nigel, who made the complaint, interviewing Ellie, who is the person that he's kissed, and then also talking to the parishioners, including Colin, who is not the most helpful of people to talk to. And we see all this kind of evidence building up in a case against Adam, and it's painful to watch of how things you have said can be misconstrued, and you know what you think people see of you is different from how they actually see you, and all of this stuff is hard watch.
What is true?
Absolutely.
So it's very much a parallel to, because also on Maundy Thursday, overnight into Good Friday, you have the arrest and trial of Jesus. And there is that spiralling out of control, false accusations or exaggerated accusations. And we're seeing that happen to Adam as well. And at the same time, so while that trial is happening for Jesus, we have Simon Peter, who denies Jesus and knowing Jesus three times. And in Rev, we see Colin, who is Adam's great friend, deny knowing Adam three times. Yeah.
Such a fascinating little scene, because he's homeless, begging by an ATM, and someone comes to get cash out and says, "Oh, weren't you friends with that vicar?" And he denies, "No, I didn't know him, I didn't know him." And then after that, there's like it cuts to the chicken shop opposite.
Yeah.
And I think there's burger alarm goes off.
Yeah.
And it's just a really gorgeous little Easter egg. To the way that Simon Peter hears a cock crow three times after he has denied Jesus.
And it's worth mentioning as well, at this point the story's been blown out of proportion as to what actually happened. And there's a bit with Alex where she's really faithful to Adam. Mm. And because there's a newspaper report saying that actually it wasn't just a kiss, it was Adam and Ellie had sex in her office, I believe, is what Colin's spreading around. Alex is just like, I know that's not what happened. It's okay. At the point that you just see Adam breaking with the pressure of everything that's happened, because someone's come and graffitied the vicarage and all this stuff. He's just in a really horrible, terrible place.
Yeah, and we see that carried through then to the next episode where, spoiler alert, Adam is working in the local shop. And Colin comes in and just hurls accusations at Adam about being the worst vicar ever, and almost the worst person ever. Like, and all the things bad with the church, what you've done is worse than anything. It's really painful seeing how the people who were Adam's supporters and were his parishioners and the people that he loved turn their backs on him. And we also have someone else comes to the door. Adoa comes to the door, and you know, is really, really angry and upset with him.
Disappointed.
And it's and disappointed. And it's and all the while you're thinking, it was a kiss. Like, yes, conduct not becoming of the clergy, but not anything like it's being made out to be.
Often we talk in the church during Holy Week of how the crowds who were there for his triumphal entry are the same crowds who are then calling for him to be crucified on Maundy Thursday, Good Friday. And I think we see that in those reactions, the people who were his biggest friends and supporters becoming his vilest critics.
And actually, in the final trial, which happens before the crowds with Pontius Pilate, where Pilate, as a tradition around the Passover, would pardon one of the people who had been arrested, and it's up to the crowd to choose who to pardon, whether it's a murderer or Jesus. And they pardon Jesus Barabbas, rather than Jesus of Nazareth. And again, it's that Colin saying, of all the things in the church, for what you've done is the worst. Well, it's, you know, it's really, really painful, really painful. Which brings us into Good Friday, and Bishop washes his hands, just as Pilate washes his hands.
That was a bit that really, really hit me, because it's after some other things have happened, and Adam's decided to step away and resign from his job, but also kind of, he's not said he wants to leave the priesthood, but it's kind of implied that he's just like, I just don't want to be a rev anymore. And the bishop...
He starts to apply for other jobs.
Yeah, he says, the church doesn't want me, let me go.
Yeah, so before he starts applying for other jobs and things like that, though, he goes and tells the bishop that this is his plan. And the bishop looks down at his hands and sees he's got something on his hands and so goes off and washes them and then dries them and just...
It's from the chocolate factory.
Is it? And the symbolism of that. And you know, those who've gone through pain of being part of the church and not feeling wanted and loved and appreciated, and witnessing the bishop wash his hands of you, of going, right, that's your decision that you've made, off you go. That was, that hit me in the stomach, that one, that bit. I think of all this episode, I found that bit probably the most painful.
Whereas for me, maybe not painful, but what really hit me was, I mean, as Adam was carrying the cross through the streets and being having abuse hurled at him, but then he reaches the hill and he plants the cross.
It's set up earlier on in the episode that a cross is needed from, it's being stored in Adam's garage, and another vicar needs it for their Holy Week activities or whatever. And in the middle of the night, slightly crazed, Adam decides that now is the time for him to deliver that cross to this other vicar in London. And Alex tries to stop him. She says, don't, you know, he can wait, but he goes ahead and does it anyway. And what we get is this really gorgeous sort of scene. It's heartbreaking, it's gut-wrenching, as Adam... This small, broken priest carries this huge cross through the streets of London, and you see London nightlife, you see people spitting on him, but then they also take on the faces of his parishioners and the people that he's and he falls down, and that, you know, in the Stations of the Cross, which is a service where... we remember and walk through a series of reflections based on Jesus carrying the cross to Golgotha. So there's beautiful allusion to that. So there is somebody who does say, you need to hang with that mate, which makes me think of Simon of Cyrene, who is someone who is actually forced to help Jesus carry the cross. And it's that, it, for me, it's that walk that is the thing that, like, it kind of, like, lives wrench-free in my head. Like, every now and again, it will just come into my head as just a beautiful allegory of the Stations of the Cross. But, Kate, it's the bit that comes after that that's like.
What was really powerful to me, so I think I mentioned that we used to do walks of witness in my market town growing up, and we'd finish on a hill, planting a cross on a hill, and this for me visually reminded me of that, erecting the cross there. And but Adam's doing this not with a group of people but on his own, and he plants it, and on the top of this hill by the cross he starts to sing Lord of the Dance.
I hate that hymn so much.
Which is an Easter hymn. He starts it kind of just almost under his breath, but when he he throws himself into it and he starts dancing like a fool as well. And in the hymn itself, although clergy have a love-hate relationship with it, I think, it's got some really deep theology in it about, the dance of Jesus, who created all things at the beginning, is then lifted high on the cross, but then dances for new creation with the resurrection. Check out the words to that hymn at some point, because they're actually quite good.
Maybe don't, because some of them are slightly interesting. I remember very clearly a wedding that I did where this got sung. Yeah. And in the particular verse about being whipped and stripped, I caught the eye of the bridesmaids, and all of them just fell about laughing, going,
what? Yes, so it is an Easter hymn, and it is about Holy Week. I think that the problem is that people pick it because it's happy and jumpy, and it sounds like, it's all Lord of the Dance. That sounds
and
silly.
They remember it from primary school.
And they don't really, but thematically it is about, you know, Jesus being tortured and humiliated and then crucified.
To a jolly tune.
Which is maybe not wedding appropriate. but in the appropriate setting, it is. I actually quite like it. I'll put myself out there. Yeah. I like Lord of the Dance in the right context.
The way Adam does it is nice in this episode.
It works. No, I'm glad it exists because actually it's a really beautiful kind of subversion, because actually he's at his lowest point and then is and that's maybe that's why it works so well, because this hymn is so weirdly joyful, almost manically joyful, when we're singing about Jesus' torture and execution.
And Adam is doing it on top of a hill, alone by the cross, looking like a fool, because you can feel that he's almost broken through there with a look through into the rawness of spirit and saying, "Dance then, wherever you may be. I'm the Lord of the dance," said he. And someone comes and starts dancing and singing with him in the foolishness, in the recklessness. And they go and sit by each other and have a conversation. And it's God.
It's only Liam Neeson. It's only Aslan.
Oh, of course, he's Aslan as well, isn't he? Yeah, the bit with Liam Neeson appearing and just the way he talks and dances with Adam to start off with, and then sits with him, and
he's wearing like this 90s sort of what are they called?
Shell suit.
Shell suit. A bit garish, but joyful.
And I think maybe reflects for Adam, who he's been seeing Jesus in for the whole of the series, in that you don't see Jesus in the bishops and the archdeacons and the super holy people. Actually, you're seeing Jesus in the everyday people and the people who are most in need. But people like Colin, actually. And this facsimile of God, this representation of God, says something like, "I'm always with you."
So it's fascinating, because this guy just comes out with all of these sort of random phrases like, "Oh, if you want to make omelets, you've got to break some eggs," and these are like, this is the least helpful stuff ever. But then God calls Adam by name and says, "Adam, I think it is, I am always with you." And then he's kind of gone.
It's surreal.
It's surreal and spiritual and kind of glorious.
And I think a very real interpretation of how you encounter God, with the weird, incomprehensible stuff alongside those glimpses of truth, where we do have to wade through the odd stuff and the weird phrases, the weird sayings, the strangeness.
It's giving Jonah in the belly of the whale. It's giving the psalm, which is, you can go as far east, you can go as far west, you can go to the bottoms of the sea, I will be with you. And that's such a Holy Saturday moment in some ways, that, yes, it's Good Friday, and we see that as an opportunity to reflect on how far gone Jesus seems to be from God. And often you get horrible theology in some really, bad theologically framed songs, which say, like, the Father turns his face away, and things like that. And actually what we get when we sit with the horror of Jesus' execution and his death is that actually, no, God is still with us even there. And that, to me, I think, over the last year or so, has just been the gospel. God is with us. It's the Christmas story. God is with us. It's Easter story. God is with us.
It's the tearing of the curtain in the moments of Jesus' last breath, reminding us that even on Good Friday, when everything seems like it's lost, you've got that little voice saying, "God's not dead, no. God is alive. God's not dead, no. He is alive. Or at least for me, as much as we're in the mourning of Good Friday and the mourning and despair of Holy Saturday, underneath there's that heartbeat and expectation of God's not dead. God's not dead. Yeah.
We're moving into Holy Saturday. Mm. And actually elsewhere in the episode, there is another Holy Saturday moment, which I think is when we see Adam confined to his bed, unable to really get up or do anything. Ruthie, you wanted to mention something here.
Yeah, this is a bit that really kind of hits home as well, because as a priest who has been signed off work for a while with depression and being stuck in that place of being in my bed and not able to get up and not able to do anything, and yeah, it was that was another very real moment for me of understanding that pain of just being stuck, and like his daughter's crying and you hear over the monitor Alex talking with the daughter and saying where's daddy and that kind of thing, and he's just in tears curled up in bed saying sorry I can't. And it's, yeah, in this Holy Saturdays, this really bizarre holy day. It makes sense, doesn't it, that actually you're in between, you're in the it's happened but we know what's coming but not yet, and all of this, and it also, yeah, being in that place is a horrible place to be. And you have to kind of sit in it for a while. Like, you can't just go, snap, right, next day, it's all good. You know, he goes through this in this episode, and I've gone through it myself, of just being in such a deep, dark place that you need to rest and wait and be with that. But one of the things I've just thought of is that he doesn't lose his faith in all this. He has a crisis of kind of identity and if he should be a priest, if he should be a rev and all this stuff. But even when he's curled in bed in that place, he's reciting the Beatitudes, isn't he? He's saying, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit. And that's reflected with the prayers of parishioners. Mm. So you've heard Adam's inner monologue of praying, but then you hear it from other people. So you hear it from Alex, who isn't a believer particularly, you know, but, you know, says, God, I've not spoken to you for a while, but here's how I'm feeling. You hear it in the Archdeacon, and we've already mentioned this, but being in this place of darkness and despair and yet holding on to God in that bit is just, it's beautifully done. It's amazing.
And I think also that, I think one of the most powerful things that you can realise is that when you are struggling to pray, other people are praying for you. And you can rest in the support of other people's prayers. And that's what's happening, is you have Alex and you have Colin. And in a way, you also have the Archdeacon and Nigel. All these other people are praying. I think we can get so caught up in our own egocentrism with this idea that it's our internal monologue, which is the most important. If I'm not praying, then... is everything's wrong. It's actually, we can rest in the prayers of others as well.
Yeah.
I think it's also, this is also an opportunity just to call out a name, the fact that if you are someone who suffers from lives with depression or similar, that doesn't mean that you are somewhat lacking in faith.
Mm.
It does not mean that you are a bad Christian in any way. Actually, the faith can be the thing that carries you through the depression. Not to make you better, but to be with you through it.
Yeah, with you in the tomb and out of the tomb. That's Jesus' promise, is he's with us wherever we go.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say, Ruthie?
Yeah, I think so. There were definitely times that was a lesson I had to learn. And it was the only thing, it was one of the big things that stopped me from going on medication as part of it, that I was a Christian and therefore I was supposed to be happy all the time and everything was fine. And I shouldn't need these little pills to make me feel better. lo and behold, I've needed these pills for a very long year, for very many years. And yes, sometimes I'm off them, but you know, I'm at a state right now where I'm not. And yeah, knowing that you're not just suddenly an epic failure as a Christian because you have these dark moods that just plague you is something I've had to learn and still don't always remember it very well. I think that's just part of dealing with depression. That's just part of your psyche. You just think you're rubbish at everything for a long time. But yeah, that's a really important point to make. So thanks, Ross. Thanks for the reminder.
And not just mental health as well, actually physical health. We all have difficulties and struggles. And, you know, if you're in pain, you take the painkillers. Or if there's medication that can help you, take the medication. And you're not a failure just because, you know, your faith hasn't healed you and the faith hasn't made you superhuman. Actually, the faith is Jesus being with you, working through the difficulties, working through the wilderness and the desert and the tomb, and supporting you and giving you what you need to keep going and find the help that you need. But it's difficult.
Which we then see on Easter Sunday, that Alex has gone and rounded up the troops to give Adam a bit of hope and to recognise that he is important, that he's valued, that he's done amazing things. And they meet. She wakes him up at 5 a.m, which is cruel. But it might be 5:30, which is still cruel, but not as cruel as 5. And she's gathered all the kind of key people that we've talked about in the series of Red outside of church for the Easter Vigil, for a bonfire outside. And the neighbour's not very happy about the fact that they're there. And then they break into church, don't they? do that. And initially, Adam's really upset that these people have been gathered, but then Alex talks to him and just says, you know, I've not done this for you, I've done it for them. And sometimes that's the kick that priests have that go, do you know what, it's not about you sometimes, and actually it's about them. Sometimes it absolutely is about you, and you need to protect yourself and look after yourself. But you also do, you know, you're given cure of souls. You've got responsibility for the folks in your parish, and everyone in that situation there needed closure.
And Alex knows that's what Adam needs to address for himself and for them. There's a really lovely moment where Alex is resolved to do a thing. And the person that we see her approach first is Ellie, the head teacher. And she says, I forgive you. And it just occurred to me that actually this is an action that comes from the work of reconciliation and forgiveness and kind of absolution, if you like. And from that, we get this wonderful work of hope and an Easter service.
And for Adam, it's so important that he has this moment with his former parishioners, because I don't know about you, but when things go wrong, I have a tendency to self-flagellate. I tend to punish myself and try to do penance for when stuff goes wrong. And I blame myself and my brain says, everyone's disappointed in you, everyone hates you, you've got to make things right. And when you can't do that, you fall into the depths of despair. And that's what Adam has. And it's really important for him to see that these people, yes, they were going through the storm of accusations, but actually they still want to worship with him. And they still welcome him to take that Easter service. And I think it's a very cathartic thing for him to see them in friendship and celebration, where the last time he's encountered them has been in condemnation.
The worship that they have looks like an Easter Vigil, where they light a fire, and they just use like a metal drum and filled that with wood from somewhere, and said that and they light the Easter candle, and we hear the singing of the Exultet, which is a hymn prayer sung often by a deacon, if there's one available. If not, then it'll be the priest or a cantor. singing about the new light that is in Christ. Mm. And often that candle is lit outside and then carried into the dark church. We see that happen. And it's a really beautiful piece of music. I had to sing it to the curate. I messed it up massively.
Did you?
Yeah, the choir would never let me forget it. But there is something about, I think, Adam singing it, which is beautiful. And kind of him grounding himself back in his, perhaps, ordination vows or as a priest, as a deacon.
At my Easter morning, the dawn service that we do, which we've now done 2 years in a row and we'll do it a third year, which we hold in the churchyard, outside of a church, around a fire pit, we sing the Exalted together, and we do a version which is to the tune of Tell Out My Soul.
Oh, nice.
So far we've timed it well enough that the birds join in, the dawn chorus joins in, and let me tell you what an emotional punch that is,
amazing.
Singing the Exalted with all of creation. And the final part of this service that Adam has on Easter morning is a baptism. For his daughter.
Yeah.
And this, traditionally, that's when baptisms will be held in the church, would be at the Easter service. And it's also when we renew baptismal vows for everyone. And it's a really lovely moment of new life and hope, drawing things to a close, really, for Adam at St. Saviour's.
Yeah.
We get another little sort of prayer monologue, I think, from Adam. But that's kind of where the sitcom ends. And it's kind of a really interesting, we're seeing the death of a church community, but we're also seeing the new life. We're ending on hope. Nothing is ever the end because God is with us.
Yeah. And what we are left with is, we're not shown it, but the absence after this. So some churches might do an empty tomb service for Sunday after Easter, which is, I've done it once before, but it's a space for saying, we've had the big celebrations of Easter, but for us and for the disciples, the tomb's still empty, and Jesus isn't here in the same way. And I think for the St. Saviour's congregation and for that community, the church is still empty and sold off and has been dissolved. The empty tomb service can be really powerful because it is praying for hope and learning to recognise Jesus in this new way as he walks among us in resurrection. And that's something which I think is a really poignant place maybe for us to draw to a close. Is wondering, where do we see hope in this season as we've gone through the great highs and lows of Holy Week, as we've gone through the highs and lows of Adam's story, as we go through the highs and lows of our own lives, where do we find hope even in the emptiness, and how do we adjust to these new ways of living? One of the things we'd really like to encourage you to do is this Easter, if you are someone who believes in Jesus, go to an Easter service and renew your baptismal vows, because it's a fantastic opportunity to make that decision to face new life again.
And even if you're not, go and see what it's about. See what's going on. Experience a bit of Easter. See what you make of it.
Whatever you're doing this Holy Week and whatever you're doing this Easter, we pray that the risen Christ may live in your life and in your heart once again.
Amen.
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 We hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Vicar's Watch Dibley. Thank you to Nat for editing our ramblings.
Any opinions expressed are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Church of England or any other organisation with which we are affiliated.
If you like our podcast, leave us a review, follow us on social media and share it with your friends. And, as always, bless you for listening.
What do you call a fly with no wings?
I don't know.
A walk.
I didn't hear it.
A walk. That's the biggest eye roll I've ever seen you do towards me.